No. There could be no otherwise. Finally, we reached Santa Barbara, and I saw why Caligula might like the place. If I squinted, I could imagine I was back in the Roman resort town of Baiae. The curve of the coastline was almost the same, as well as the golden beaches, the hills dotted with upscale stucco and red-tiled homes, the pleasure craft moored in the harbor. The locals even had the same sun-baked, pleasantly dazed expressions, as if they were biding their time between morning surf sessions and afternoon golf. The biggest difference? Mount Vesuvius did not rise in the distance. But I had a feeling another presence loomed over this lovely little town, just as dangerous and volcanic. "He'll be here," I said, as we parked the van on Cabrillo Boulevard. Piper arched her eyebrows. "Are you sensing a disturbance in the force?" "Please," I muttered. "I'm sensing my usual bad luck. In a place this harmless-looking, there's no way we will not find trouble." We spent the afternoon canvassing the Santa Barbara waterfront, from the east beach to the breakwater jetties. We disrupted a flock of pelicans in the saltwater marsh. We woke some napping sea lions on the fishing dock. We jostled through roving hordes of tourists on Stern's Wharf. In the harbor, we found a virtual forest of single-mast boats, along with some luxury yachts, but none seemed large or gaudy enough for a Roman emperor. Jason even flew over the water for aerial reconnaissance. When he came back, he reported no suspicious vessels on the horizon.
"Were you on your horse, Tempest, just then?" Meg asked. "I couldn't tell."
Jason smiled. "Nah, I don't call Tempest unless it's an emergency. I was just flying around on my own, manipulating the wind."
Meg pouted, considering the pockets of her gardening belt. "I can summon yams."
At last, we gave up searching and grabbed a table at a beachside cafe. The grilled fish tacos were worthy of an ode by the muse Euterpe herself.
"I don't mind giving up," I admitted,
spooning some spicy ceviche into my mouth.
"If it comes with dinner."
"This is just a break," Meg warned. "Don't get comfortable."
I wished she hadn't phrased that as an order.
It made it difficult for me to sit still for the rest of my meal.
We sat at the cafe, enjoying the breeze, the food, and the iced tea, until the sun dipped to the horizon, turning the sky Camp Half-Blood orange. I allowed myself to hope that I'd been mistaken about Caligula's presence. We'd come here in vain. Hooray! I was about to suggest heading back to the van, perhaps finding a hotel so I wouldn't have to crash in a sleeping bag at the bottom of a desert well again, when Jason rose from our picnic table bench.
"There,"
he pointed out to sea. The ship seemed to materialize from the sun's glare, the way my sun chariot used to whenever I pulled into the stables of Sunset at the end of a long day's ride. The yacht was a gleaming white monstrosity, with five decks above the waterline, its tinted black windows like elongated insect eyes. As with all big ships, it was difficult to judge its size from a distance. But the fact that it had two onboard helicopters, one aft and one forward, plus a small submarine locked in a crane on the starboard side, told me this was not an average pleasure craft. Perhaps there were bigger yachts in the mortal world, but I guessed not many.
"That has to be it," Piper said.
"What now? You think it will dock?"
"Hold on,"
Meg said.
"Look."
Another yacht, identical to the first, resolved out of the sunlight about a mile to the south.
"That must be a mirage, right?" Jason asked uneasily. "Or a decoy?"
Meg grunted in dismay, pointing out to sea yet again.
A third yacht shimmered into existence, halfway between the first two.
"This is crazy,"
Piper said. "Each one of those boats has to cost millions."
"Half a billion,"
I corrected.
"Or more?"
Caligula was never shy about spending money.
"He is part of the triumvirate. They've been accumulating wealth for centuries."
Another yacht popped onto the horizon, as if coming out of sunshine warp. Then another. Soon there were dozens, a loose armada strung across the mouth of the harbor, like a string being fitted on a bow.
"No way,"
Piper rubbed her eyes. "This has to be an illusion."
"It's not." My heart sank. I'd seen this sort of display before.
As we watched, the line of super yachts maneuvered closer together, anchoring themselves stern to bow, forming a glittering, floating blockade from Sycamore Creek all the way to the marina, a mile long at least.
"The Bridge of Boats," I said.
"He's done it again."
"Again?"
Meg asked.
"Caligula, back in ancient times." I tried to control the quavering in my voice.
"When he was a boy, he received a prophecy. A Roman astrologer told him he had as much chance of becoming emperor as he did of riding a horse across the Bay of Baiae. In other words, it was impossible.
But Caligula did become emperor. So he ordered the construction of a fleet of superyachts."
I gestured feebly at the armada in front of us.
"Like this."
He lined the boats up across the Bay of Baiae, forming a massive bridge. Then he rode across it on his horse. It was the biggest floating construction project ever attempted.
Caligula couldn't even swim.
That didn't faze him. He was determined to thumb his nose at fate. Piper steepled her hands over her mouth.
"The mortals have to see this, right? He can't just cut off all boat traffic in and out of the harbor."
"Oh, the mortals notice," I said.
"Look."
Smaller boats began to gather around the yachts, like flies drawn to a sumptuous feast. I spotted two Coast Guard vessels, several local police boats, and dozens of inflatable dinghies with outboard motors, manned by dark-clad men with guns. The Emperor's private security, I guessed.
"They're helping,"
Meg murmured, a hard edge to her voice.
"Even Nero never..."
"He paid off the police, had lots of mercenaries, but he never showed off this much." Jason gripped the hilt of his gladius.
"Where do we even start? How do we find Caligula and all of that?"
I didn't want to find Caligula at all. I wanted to run. The idea of death, permanent death, with five whole letters and a D at the beginning, suddenly seemed very close. But I could feel my friend's confidence wavering.
They needed a plan, not a screaming, panicking Lester.
I pointed toward the center of the floating bridge. "We start in the middle, the weakest point of a chain." Chapter 25. All in the same boat. Wait. Two of us disappeared. Half in the same boat. Jason Grace ruined that perfectly good line. As we tromped toward the surf, he sidled up next to me and murmured,
"It's not true, you know. The middle of a chain has the same tensile strength as everywhere else, assuming force is applied equally along the links."
I sighed. "Are you making up for missing our physics lecture? You know what I meant."
"I actually don't," he said. "Why attack in the middle?"
"Because... I don't know," I said.
"They won't be expecting it."
Meg stopped at the water's edge.
"Looks like they're expecting anything."
She was right. As the sunset faded to purple, the yachts lit up like giant Fabergé eggs. Spotlights swept the sky and sea as if advertising the biggest waterbed mattress sale in history. Dozens of small patrol boats crisscrossed the harbor, just in case any Santa Barbara locals, Santa Barbarians, had the nerve to try using their own coast. I wondered if Caligula always had this much security, or if he was expecting us. By now he certainly knew we'd blown up Macro's military madness. He'd also probably heard about our fight with Medea in the maze, assuming the sorceress had survived. Caligula also had the Sybil of Erythria, which meant he had access to the same information Herophily had given Jason. The Sybil might not want to help an evil emperor who kept her in molten shackles, but she couldn't refuse any earnest petitioner posing direct questions. Such was the nature of oracular magic. I imagined the best she could do was give her answers in the form of really difficult crossword puzzle clues. Jason studied the sweep of the searchlights. I could fly you guys over, one at a time. Maybe they won't see us. I think we should avoid flying if possible, I said. And we should find a way over there before it gets much darker. Piper pushed her windblown hair from her face. Why? Darkness gives us better cover. Strixes, I said. They become active about an hour after sundown. Strixes? Piper asked. I recounted our experience with the birds of doom in the labyrinth. Meg offered helpful editorial comments like, yuck, uh-huh, and Apollo's fault. Piper shuddered. In Cherokee stories, owls are bad news. They tend to be evil spirits or spying medicine men. If these Strixes are like giant blood-sucking owls, yeah, let's not meet them. Agreed, Jason said. But how do we get to the ships? Piper stepped into the waves. Maybe we ask for a lift. She raised her arms and waved at the nearest dinghy, about 50 yards out, as it swept its light across the beach. Piper? Jason asked. Meg summoned her swords. It's fine. When they get close, I'll take them out. I stared at my young master. Meg, those are mortals. First of all, your swords will not work on them. Second, they don't understand whom they're working for. We can't... They're working for the bad man, she said. Caligula. I noticed her slip of the tongue. I had a feeling she'd been about to say, working for the beast. She put away her blades, but her voice remained cold and determined. I had a sudden horrible image of McCaffrey the Avenger assaulting the boat with nothing but her fists and packets of gardening seeds. Jason looked at me as if to ask, "Do you need to tie her down or should I?" The dinghy veered toward us. Aboard sat three men in dark fatigues, Kevlar vests, and riot helmets. One in back operated the outboard motor, one in front manned the searchlight. The one in the middle, no doubt the friendliest, had an assault rifle propped on his knee. Piper waved and smiled at them. Meg, don't attack. I've got this. All of you, give me some space to work, please. I can charm these guys better if you're not glowering behind me. This was not a difficult request. The three of us backed away, though Jason and I had to drag Meg. Hello? Piper called as the boat came closer. Don't shoot! We're friendly. The boat ran aground with such speed I thought it might keep driving right onto Cabrillo Boulevard. Mr. Searchlight jumped out first, surprisingly agile for a guy in body armor. Mr. Assault Rifle followed, providing cover while Mr. Engine cut the outboard motor. Searchlight sized us up, his hand on his sidearm.
Who are you?
I'm Piper, said Piper. You don't need to call this in. and you definitely don't need to train that rifle on us.
Searchlight's face contorted.
He started to match Piper's smile,
then seemed to remember that his job required him to glower.
Assault rifle did not lower his gun.
Engine reached for his walkie-talkie.
IDs, barked Searchlight. All of you.
Next to me, Meg tensed, ready to become McCaffrey the Avenger.
Jason tried to look inconspicuous, but his dress shirt crackled with static electricity.
Sure,
Piper agreed.
Although, I have a much better idea. I'm just going to reach in my pocket, okay? Don't get excited.
She pulled out a wad of cash, maybe $100 total. For all I knew, it represented the last of the McLean fortune.
My friends and I were talking, Piper continued, about how hard you guys work, how difficult it must be patrolling the harbor. We were sitting over there at that cafe eating these incredible fish tacos, and we thought, hey, those guys deserve a break. We should buy them dinner.
Searchlight's eyes seemed to become unmoored from his brain.
Dinner break?
Absolutely, Piper said. You can put down that heavy gun, toss that walkie-talkie away. Heck, you can just leave everything with us. We'll watch it while you eat. Grilled snapper, homemade corn tortillas, ceviche salsa.
She glanced back at us.
Amazing food, right, guys?
We mumbled our assent.
Yum, Meg said. She excelled at one-syllable answers.
Assault Rifle lowered his gun.
I could use some fish tacos.
We've been working hard,
Engine agreed. We deserve a dinner break.
Exactly.
Piper pressed the money into Searchlight's hand.
Our treat. Thank you for your service.
Searchlight stared at the wad of cash.
But we're really not supposed to.
Eat with all that gear on, Piper suggested. You're absolutely right. Just throw it all in the boat. The Kevlar, the guns, your cell phones. That's right. Get comfortable.
It took several more minutes of cajoling and lighthearted banter, but finally the three mercenaries had stripped down to just their commando pajamas. They thanked Piper, gave her a hug for good measure, then jogged off to assault the beachside cafe. As soon as they were gone, Piper stumbled into Jason's arms.
Whoa, you okay?
He asked.
Fine.
She pushed away awkwardly. Just harder charming a whole group.
I'll be okay.
That was impressive, I said. Aphrodite herself could not have done better. Piper didn't look pleased by my comparison.
We should hurry. The charm won't last.
Meg grunted.
Still would have been easier to kill...
Meg, I chided.
To beat them unconscious,
she amended.
Right.
Jason cleared his throat.
Everybody in the boat.
We were 30 yards offshore when we heard the mercenaries shouting,
Hey, stop!
They ran into the surf, holding half-eaten fish tacos and looking confused. Fortunately, Piper had taken all their weapons and communications devices. She gave them a friendly wave, and Jason gunned the outboard motor. Jason, Meg, and I rushed to put on the guards' Kevlar vests and helmets. This left Piper in civilian clothes, but since she was the only one capable of bluffing her way through a confrontation, she let us have all the fun playing dress-up. Jason made a perfect mercenary. Meg looked ridiculous, a little girl swimming in her father's Kevlar. I didn't look much better. The body armor chafed around my middle.
Curse you, uncombat-worthy love handles.
The riot helmet was as hot as an easy-bake oven, and the visor kept falling down, perhaps anxious to hide my acne-riddled face. We tossed the guns overboard.
That That may sound foolish, but as I've said, firearms are fickle weapons in the hands of demigods. They would work on mortals, but no matter what Meg said, I didn't want to go around mowing down regular humans. I had to believe that if these mercenaries truly understood whom they were serving, they too would throw down their arms. Surely humans would not blindly follow such an evil man of their own free will. I mean, except for the few hundred exceptions I could think of from human history. But not Caligula. As we approached the yachts, Jason slowed, matching our speed to that of the other patrol vessels. He angled toward the nearest yacht. Up close, it towered above us like a white steel fortress. Purple and gold running lights glowed just below the water's surface, so the vessel seemed to float on an ethereal cloud of imperial Roman power. Painted along the prow of the ship, in black letters taller than me, was the name Julia Drusilla the 26th.
Julia Drusilla the 26th, Piper said. Was she an empress?
No, I said. The Emperor's favorite sister. My chest tightened as I remembered that poor girl. So pretty, so agreeable, so incredibly out of her depth. Her brother Caligula had doted on her, idolized her. When he became emperor, he insisted she share his every meal, witness his every depraved spectacle, partake in all his violent revels. She had died at 22. Crushed by the suffocating love of a sociopath. She was probably the only person Caligula ever cared about, I said. But why this boat is numbered 26, I don't know.
Because that one is 25.
Meg pointed to the next ship in line, its stern resting a few feet from our prow. Sure enough, painted across the back was Julia Drusilla the 25th.
I bet the one behind us is number 27.
50 super yachts, I mused. All named for Julia Drusilla.
Yes, that sounds like Caligula.
Jason scanned the side of the hull. There were no ladders, no hatches, no conveniently labeled red buttons. Press here for Caligula's shoes. We didn't have much time. We had made it inside the perimeter of patrol vessels and searchlights, but each yacht surely had security cameras. It wouldn't be long before someone wondered why our little dinghy was floating beside 26. Also, the mercenaries we'd left on the beach would be doing their best to attract their comrades' attention. Then there were the flocks of strixes that I imagined would be waking up any minute, hungry and alert for any sign of disembowelable intruders.
I'll fly you guys up, Jason decided. One at a time.
Me first, Piper said, in case someone needs charming.
Jason turned and let Piper lock her arms around his neck, as if they'd done this countless times before. The winds kicked up around the dinghy, ruffling my hair, and Jason and Piper floated up the side of the yacht. Oh, how I envied Jason Grace. Such a simple thing it was to ride the winds. As a god, I could have done it with half my manifestations tied behind my back. Now, stuck in my pathetic body, complete with love handles, I could only dream of such freedom.
Hey!
Meg nudged me.
Focus.
I gave her an indignant harumph.
I am pure focus. I might, however, ask where your head is.
She scowled.
What do you mean?
Your rage, I said. The number of times you've talked about killing Caligula, your willingness to beat his mercenaries unconscious.
They're the enemy.
Her tone was as sharp as scimitars, giving me fair warning that if I continued with this topic, she might add my name to her beat unconscious list. I decided to take a lesson from Jason, to navigate toward my target at a slower, less direct angle.
Meg, have I ever told you about the first time I became mortal?
She peered from under the rim of her ridiculously large helmet. You messed up or something?
Yes, I messed up.
My father, Zeus, killed one of my favorite sons, Asclepius, for bringing people back from the dead without permission. Long story. The point is, I was furious with Zeus, but he was too powerful and scary for me to fight. He would have vaporized me. So I took my revenge out in another way. I peered at the top of the hall. I saw no sign of Jason or Piper. Hopefully that meant they had found Caligula's shoes and were just waiting for a clerk to bring them a pair in the right size. Anyway, I continued, I couldn't kill Zeus. So I found the guys who had made his lightning bolts, the Cyclopes. I killed them in revenge for Asclepius. As punishment, Zeus made me mortal. Meg kicked me in the shin.
Ow!
I yelped. What was that for?
For being dumb, she said. Killing the Cyclopes was dumb.
I wanted to protest that this had happened thousands of years ago, but I feared it might just earn me another kick.
Yes, I agreed. It was dumb. But my point is, I was projecting my anger onto someone else. Someone safer.
I think you might be doing the same thing now, Meg. You're raging at Caligula because it's safer than raging at your stepfather.
I braced my shins for more pain.
Meg stared down at her Kevlar-coated chest. That's not what I'm doing.
I don't blame you, I hastened to add. Anger is good. It means you're making progress.
But be aware that you might be angry right now at the wrong person. I don't want you charging blindly into battle against this particular emperor. As hard as it is to believe, he is even more devious and deadly than the beast.
She clenched her fists. I told you, I'm not doing that. You don't know. You don't get it.
You're right, I said. What you had to endure in Nero's house, I can't imagine. No one should suffer like that, but...
Shut up!
She snapped. So, of course, I did. The words I'd been planning to say avalanched back down my throat.
You don't know, she said again. This Caligula guy did plenty to my dad and me. I can be mad at him if I want. I'll kill him if I can. I'll...
She faltered, as if struck by a sudden thought.
Where's Jason? He should be back by now.
I glanced up. I would have screamed if my voice were working. Two large, dark figures dropped toward us in a controlled, silent descent on what appeared to be parasails. Then I realized those were not parasails. They were giant ears. In an instant, the creatures were upon us. They landed gracefully on either end of our dinghy, their ears folding around them, their swords at our throats. The creatures looked very much like the big-ear guard Piper had hit with her dart at the entrance to the burning maze, except these were older and had black fur. Their blades were blunt-tipped with serrated double edges, equally suited for bashing or hacking. With a jolt, I recognized the weapons as khandas, from the Indian subcontinent. I would have been pleased with myself for remembering such an obscure fact, had I not at that moment had a khanda's serrated edge across my jugular vein. Then I had another flash of recollection. I remembered one of Dionysus's many drunken stories about his military campaigns in India, how he had come across a vicious tribe of demi-humans, with eight fingers, huge ears, and furry faces.
Why couldn't I have thought of that sooner? What had Dionysus told me about them?
Ah, yes. His exact words were, never, ever try to fight them.
Your Pandai,
I managed to croak.
That's what your race is called.
The one next to me bared his beautiful white teeth.
Indeed, Now be nice little prisoners and come along. Otherwise, your friends are dead.
Chapter 26. Oh, Florence and Grunk, la-di-da, something, something, I'll get back to you. Perhaps Jason, the physics expert, could explain to me how Pandai flew.
I didn't get it.
Somehow, even while carrying us, our captors managed to launch themselves skyward with nothing but the flapping of their tremendous lobes. I wished Hermes could see them. He would never again brag about being able to wiggle his ears. The Pandai dropped us unceremoniously on the starboard deck, where two more of their kind held Jason and Piper at arrow point. One of those guards appeared smaller and younger than the others, with white fur instead of black. Judging from the sour look on his face, I guessed he was the same guy Piper had shot down with Grandpa Tom's special recipe in downtown Los Angeles. Our friends were on their knees, their hands zip-tied behind their backs, their weapons confiscated. Jason had a black eye. The side of Piper's head was matted with blood. I rushed to her aid, being the good person I was, and poked at her cranium, trying to determine the extent of her injury.
"Ow,"
she muttered, pulling away. "I'm fine." "You could have a concussion," I said. Jason sighed miserably.
"That's supposed to be my job. I'm always the one who gets knocked in the head." "Sorry, guys. Things didn't exactly go as planned."
The largest guard, who had carried me aboard, cackled with glee.
"The girl tried to charm speak us. Pandai, who hear every nuance of speech. The boy tried to fight us. Pandai! Who trained from birth to master every weapon. Now you will all die." "Die! Die!"
barked the other Pandai. Though I noticed the white-furred youngster did not join in. He moved stiffly, as if his poison-darted leg still bothered him. Meg glanced from enemy to enemy, probably gauging how fast she could take them all down. The arrows pointed at Jason and Piper's chests made for tricky calculations.
"Meg, don't," Jason warned. "These guys, they're ridiculously good. And fast." "Fast! Fast!"
The Pandai barked in agreement. I scanned the deck. No additional guards were running toward us. No searchlights were trained on our position. No horns blared. Somewhere inside the boat, gentle music played. Not the sort of soundtrack one might expect during an incursion. The Pandai had not raised a general alarm. Despite their threats, they had not yet killed us. They'd even gone to the trouble of zip-tying Piper's and Jason's hands. Why? I turned to the largest guard. "Good sir, are you the panda in charge?"
He hissed. "The singular form is Pandos. I hate being called a panda. Do I look like a panda?"
I decided not to answer that. "Well, Mr. Pandos."
"My name is Amax,"
he snapped. "Of course, Amax." I studied his majestic ears, then hazarded an educated guess. "Imagine you hate people eavesdropping on you." Amax's furry black nose twitched.
"Why do you say this? What did you overhear?"
"Nothing," I assured him. "But I bet you have to be careful. Always other people, other Pandai snooping into your business. That's why you haven't raised an alarm yet. You know we're important prisoners. You want to keep control of the situation without anyone else taking the credit for your good work." The other Pandai grumbled.
"Vector on boat 25 is always spying,"
the dark-furred archer muttered.
"Taking credit for our ideas," said the second archer. like Kevlar ear armor.
Exactly,
I said, trying to ignore Piper, who was incredulously mouthing the words, Kevlar ear armor?
Which is why, before you do anything rash, you're going to want to hear what I have to say in private.
Amax snorted.
Ha!
His comrades echoed him.
Ha! Ha! You just lied, Amax said. I could hear it in your voice. You're afraid. You're bluffing. You have nothing to say.
I do, Meg countered. I'm Nero's stepdaughter.
Blood rushed into Amax's ears so rapidly, I was surprised he didn't faint. The shocked archers lowered their weapons.
Tambor! Crest!
Amax snapped.
Keep those arrows steady.
He glowered at Meg.
You seem to be telling the truth. What is Nero's stepdaughter doing here?
Looking for Caligula, Meg said. So I can kill him.
The Pandai's ears rippled in alarm. Jason and Piper looked at each other as if thinking, Welp, now we die. Amax narrowed his eyes.
You say you are from Nero, yet you want to kill our master. This does not make sense.
It's a juicy story,
I promised, with lots of secrets, twists, and turns. But if you kill us, you'll never hear it. If you take us to the Emperor, someone else will torture it out of us. We would gladly tell you everything. You captured us, after all. But isn't there somewhere more private we can talk, so no one will overhear? Amax glanced toward the ship's bow, as if Vector might already be listening in.
You seem to be telling the truth. But there's so much weakness and fear in your voice, it's hard to be sure.
Uncle Amax, the white-haired Pando spoke for the first time. Perhaps the pimply boy has a point. If it's valuable information.
Silence, Crest,
snapped Amax.
You've already disgraced yourself once this week.
The Pandos leader pulled more zip ties from his belt.
Tambor, peek! Bind the pimply boy and the stepdaughter of Nero. We will take them all below, interrogate them ourselves, and then hand them over to the Emperor. Yes, yes!
Barked Tambor and Peek.
So it was that three powerful demigods and one former major Olympian god were led as prisoners into a superyacht by four fuzzy creatures with ears the size of satellite dishes. Not my finest hour. Since I had reached peak humiliation, I assumed Zeus would pick that moment to recall me to the heavens, and the other gods would spend the next 100 years laughing at me. But no. I remained fully and pathetically Lester.
The guards hustled us to the aft deck, which featured 6 hot tubs, a multicolored fountain, and a flashing gold and purple dance floor, just waiting for partiers to arrive. Affixed to the stern, a red-carpeted ramp jutted across the water, connecting our boat to the prow of the next yacht. I guessed all the boats were linked this way, making a road across Santa Barbara Harbor, just in case Caligula decided to do a golf cart drive-through. Rising amidships, the upper decks gleamed with dark-tinted windows and white walls. Far above, the conning tower sprouted radar dishes, satellite antennae, and 2 billowing pennants. One with the Imperial Eagle of Rome, the other with a golden triangle on a field of purple. Which, I suppose, was the logo for Triumvirate Holdings. 2 more guards flanked the heavy oak doors that led inside. The guy on the left looked like a mortal mercenary, with the same black pajamas and body armor as the gentleman we'd sent on the wild fish taco chase. The guy on the right was a cyclops. The huge single eye gave him away. He also smelled like a cyclops,
wet wool socks.
And dressed like a cyclops. Denim cutoffs, torn black t-shirt, and a large wooden club. The human mercenary frowned at our merry band of captors and prisoners.
"What's all this?"
he asked.
"Not your concern, Florence,"
Amex growled.
"Let us through."
"Florence?" I might have snickered, except Florence weighed 300 pounds, had knife scars across his face, and still had a better name than Lester Papadopoulos.
"Regulations," Florence said. "You got prisoners. I have to call it in."
"Not yet, you won't."
Amex spread his ears like the hood of a cobra.
"This is my ship. I'll tell you when to call it in. After we interrogate these intruders."
Florence frowned at his cyclops partner.
"What do you think, Grunk?"
Now, Grunk. That was a good cyclops name. I didn't know if Florence realized he was working with the cyclops. The mist could be unpredictable. But I immediately formulated the premise for an action-adventure buddy comedy series, Florence and Grunk. If I survived captivity, I'd have to mention it to Piper's father. Perhaps he could help me schedule some lunches and pitch the idea. Oh, gods. I had been in Southern California too long. Grunk shrugged.
"It's Amex's ears on the line if the boss gets mad."
"Okay." Florence waved us through. "You all have fun."
I had little time to appreciate the opulent interior. The solid gold fixtures, the luxurious Persian carpets, the million-dollar works of art. The plush purple furniture I was pretty sure had come from Prince's estate sale. We saw no other guards or crew, which seemed strange. Then again, I supposed that even with Caligula's resources, finding enough personnel to man 50 superyachts at once might be difficult. As we walked through a walnut-paneled library hung with masterpiece paintings, Piper caught her breath. She pointed her chin toward a Joan Miró abstraction.
"That came from my dad's house," she said.
"When we get out of here," Jason muttered, "we'll take it with us."
"I heard that."
Peek jabbed his sword hilt into Jason's ribs. Jason stumbled against Piper, who stumbled into a Picasso. Seeing an opportunity, Meg surged forward, apparently meaning to tackle Amex with all 100 pounds of her weight. Before she took two steps, an arrow sprouted from the carpet at her feet.
"Don't," said Tambor. His vibrating bowstring was the only evidence he'd made the shot.
He had drawn and fired so fast, even I couldn't believe it. Meg backed away.
"Fine."
"Jeez."
The Pandai herded us into a forward lounge. Along the front wrapped a 180-degree glass wall overlooking the prow. Off to starboard, the lights of Santa Barbara twinkled. In front of us, yachts 25 through 1 made a glittering necklace of amethyst, gold, and platinum across the dark water. The sheer extravagance of it all hurt my brain, and normally I was all about extravagance. The Pandai arranged 4 plush chairs in a row and shoved us into them. As interrogation rooms went, it wasn't bad. Peek paced behind us, sword at the ready in case anyone required decapitation. Tambor and Cress lurked on either flank, their bows down but arrows knocked. Amex pulled up a chair and sat facing us, spreading his ears around him like a king's robe.
"This place is private," he announced. "Talk."
"First," I said, "I must know why you're not followers of Apollo. Such great archers. The finest hearing in the world. 8 fingers on each hand. You would make natural musicians. We seem made for each other."
Amex studied me.
"You are the former god, eh? They told us about you."
I am Apollo, I confirmed. It's not too late to pledge me your loyalty.
Amax's mouth quivered.
I hoped he was on the verge of crying, perhaps throwing himself at my feet and begging my forgiveness.
Instead, he howled with laughter.
What do we need with Olympian gods? Especially gods who are pimply boys with no power.
But there's so much I could teach you, I insisted. Music, poetry. I could teach you how to write haikus.
Jason looked at me and shook his head vigorously, though I had no idea why.
Music and poetry hurt our ears, Amex complained. We have no need of them.
I like music, Crest murmured, flexing his fingers. I can play a little.
Silence!
Amex yelled.
You can play silence for once, worthless nephew.
Aha, I thought. Even among the Pandai there were frustrated musicians.
Amex suddenly reminded me of my father, Zeus, when he came storming down the hallway on Mount Olympus. Literally storming, with thunder, lightning, and torrential rain, and ordered me to stop playing my infernal zither music.
A totally unfair demand. Everyone knows 2 a.m. is the optimal time to practice the zither. I might have been able to sway Crest to our side, if only I'd had more time. And if he weren't in the company of 3 older and larger Pandai. And if we hadn't started our acquaintance with Piper shooting him in the leg with the poisoned dart.
Amex reclined in his cushy purple throne.
We Pandai are mercenaries. We choose our masters. Why would we pick a washed-up god like you? Once we served the kings of India. Now we serve Caligula. Caligula! Caligula!
Tambourine Peak cried.
Again, Crest was conspicuously quiet, frowning at his bow.
The Emperor trusts only us, Tambor bragged.
Yes, Peak agreed. Unlike those Germani, we never stabbed him to death.
I wanted to point out that this was a fairly low bar for loyalty, but Meg interrupted.
The knight is young, she said. We could all stab him together.
Amex sneered.
I am still waiting, daughter of Nero, to hear your juicy story about why you wish to kill our master. You'd better have good information and lots of twists and turns. Convince me you are worth bringing to Caesar alive, rather than as dead bodies, and perhaps I'll get a promotion tonight. I will not be passed over again for some idiot like Overdrive on Boat 3, or Wawa on Boat 43.
Wawa?
Piper made a sound between a hiccup and a giggle,
which may have been the effect of her bashed head. Are you guys all named after guitar pedals? My dad has a collection of those. Well, he had a collection.
Amex scowled.
Guitar pedals? I don't know what that means. If you are making fun of our culture...
Hey, Meg said. You want to hear my story or not? We all turned to her. Meg? I asked. Are you sure?
The Pandai no doubt picked up on my nervous tone, but I couldn't help it. First of all, I had no idea what Meg could possibly say that would increase our chances of survival. Second, knowing Meg, she would say it in 10 words or less. Then we'd all be dead.
I got twists and turns.
She narrowed her eyes.
But are you sure we're alone, Mr. Amex? No one is listening.
Of course not, said Amex. This ship is my base. That glass is fully soundproofed.
He gestured dismissively at the ship in front of us.
Vector won't hear a word.
What about Wawa?
Meg asked.
I know he's on boat 43 with the Emperor,
But if his spies are nearby...
Ridiculous, Amex said. The Emperor isn't on boat 43.
Tambor and Peek snickered.
Boat 43 is the Emperor's footwear boat, silly girl, said Peek. An important assignment, yes, but not the throne room boat.
Right, Tambor said. That's Reverb's boat, number 12. Silence! Amex snapped. Enough delays, girl. Tell me what you know or die.
Okay.
Meg leaned forward as if to impart a secret.
Twists and turns.
Her hand shot forward, suddenly and inexplicably free of the zip tie. Her rings flashed as she threw them, turning into scimitars as they hurtled toward Amex and Peek. Chapter 27. I can kill you all, or I can sing you Joe Walsh. Really, it's your choice. The children of Demeter are all about flowers. Amber waves of grain, feeding the world and nurturing life. They also excel at planting scimitars in the chests of their enemies. Meg's imperial gold blades found their targets. One hit Amex with such force he exploded in a cloud of yellow dust. The other cut through Peek's bow, embedding itself in his sternum and causing him to disintegrate inward like sand through an hourglass. Crest fired his bow. Fortunately for me, his aim was off. The arrow buzzed past my face, the fletching scraping my chin and impaled itself in my chair. Piper kicked back in her seat, knocking into Tambor so his sword swing went wild. Before he could recover and decapitate her, Jason got overexcited.
I say that because of the lightning.
The sky outside flashed. The curved wall of glass shattered, and tendrils of electricity wrapped around Tambor, frying him into an ash pile. Effective, yes, but not the sort of stealth we'd been hoping for.
Oops, said Jason.
With a horrified whimper, Crest dropped his bow. He staggered backward, struggling to draw his sword. Meg yanked her first scimitar from Amex's dust-covered chair and marched toward him.
Meg, wait!
I said. She glared at me.
What?
I tried to raise my hands in a placating gesture, then remembered they were tied behind my back.
Crest?
I said. There's no shame in surrender. You are not a fighter. He gulped.
You don't know me.
You're holding your sword backward, I pointed out. So unless you intend to stab yourself. He fumbled to correct the situation.
Fly,
I pleaded.
This doesn't have to be your fight. Get out of here. Become the musician you want to see in the world.
He must have heard the earnestness in my voice. He dropped his sword and jumped through the gaping hole in the glass, ear sailing into the darkness.
Why'd you let him go?
Meg demanded.
He'll warn everybody.
I don't think so, I said. Also, it doesn't matter. We just announced ourselves with a literal thunderbolt.
Yeah, sorry, Jason said. Sometimes that just happens.
Lightning strikes seemed like the sort of power he really needed to get under control. But we had no time to argue about it. As Meg cut our zip ties, Florence and Grunk charged into the room. Piper yelled,
Stop!
Florence tripped and face-planted on the carpet, his rifle spraying a full clip sideways, shooting off the legs of a nearby sofa. Grunk raised his club and charged. I instinctively pulled my bow, knocked an arrow, and let it fly. Straight into the Cyclops' eye. I was stunned. I'd actually hit my target. Grunk fell to his knees, keeled over sideways, and began to disintegrate, putting an end to my plans for a cross-species buddy comedy. Piper walked up to Florence, who was groaning with a broken nose.
"Thanks for stopping," she said,
then gagged him and trussed his wrists and ankles with his own zip ties.
"Well, that was interesting,"
Jason turned to Meg.
"And what you did, incredible. Those pandai, when I tried to fight them, they disarmed me like it was child's play. But you with those swords."
Meg's cheeks reddened.
"It was no big deal."
"It was a very big deal."
Jason faced me.
"So what now?"
A muted voice buzzed in my head.
"Now the vile rogue Apollo shall remove me from this monster's eye post-haste!"
Oh, dear. I had done what I'd always feared, and sometimes dreamed of. I had mistakenly used the arrow of Dodona in combat. Its sacred point now quivered in the eye socket of Grunk, who had been reduced to nothing but his skull. A spoil of war, I supposed.
"Very sorry," I said, pulling the arrow free.
Meg snorted.
"Is that..."
"The arrow of Dodona," I said.
"And mine fury is boundless,"
the arrow intoned.
"Thou shootest me forth to slay thy foes, as if I wast a mere arrow."
"Yes, yes, I apologize. Now hush, please."
I turned to my comrades. "We need to move quickly. The security forces will be coming."
"Emperor Stupid is on boat 12, Meg said. "That's where we go."
"But the shoe boat," I said, "is 43, which is in the opposite direction."
"What if Emperor Stupid is wearing his shoes?" she asked.
"Hey,"
Jason pointed at the arrow of Dodona.
"That's the mobile source of prophecy you were telling us about, right? Maybe you should ask it."
I found that an annoyingly reasonable suggestion.
I raised the arrow.
"You heard them, oh wise arrow. Which way do we go?"
"Thou tellest me to hush, then thou askest me for wisdom. Oh fie, oh villainy! Both directions must thou pursue if thou wouldst see success. But beware, I see great pain, great suffering. Sacrifice most bloody."
"What did he say?" Piper demanded. "Oh, listener, I was so tempted to lie. I wanted to tell my friends that the arrow was in favor of returning to Los Angeles and booking rooms at a 5-star hotel."
I caught Jason's eyes.
I remembered how I had exhorted him to tell Piper the truth about the Sybil's prophecy. I decided I could do no less.
I related what the arrow had said.
"So we split up?"
Piper shook her head.
"I hate this plan."
"Me too," Jason said. "Which means it's probably the right move."
He knelt and retrieved his gladius from the dust pile remains of Tambor. Then he tossed the dagger Catoptris to Piper.
"I'm going after Caligula," he said. "Even if the shoes aren't there, maybe I can buy you guys some time. Distract the security forces."
Meg picked up her other scimitar. "I'll come with you."
Before I could argue, she took a flying leap out of the broken window, which was a pretty good metaphor for her general approach to life.
Jason gave Piper and me one last worried look. "You two be careful."
He jumped after Meg. Almost immediately, gunfire erupted on the foredeck below. I grimaced at Piper.
"Those two were our fighters. We shouldn't have let them go together."
"Don't underestimate my fighting skill," Piper said.
"Now let's go shoe shopping."
She waited only long enough for me to clean and bandage her wounded head in the nearest restroom. Then she donned Florence's combat helmet and off we went.